What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides an open forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that intersect, confront, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield. According to the U.S. Department of Education, 6 million kids receive special education. One out of every 10 children under the age of 14 has some type of special need, which includes physical, cognitive, or medical disability, or chronic or life-threatening illnesses. Tim Sweeney, whose son has Down syndrome, autism, and trouble falling asleep, shares his experiences in raising and loving a special child. Tim Sweeney left his career as a successful attorney to care full-time for his son, Timmy, who has, again, Down syndrome and autism. Tim turned his love for music into a tool for communicating with his son, who is unable to speak. Sweeney went to Nashville, Tennessee, to document his special bond he shares with his son through music. The result is his inaugural CD, this time on Oil House Records, which has garnered much attention and applause throughout the music industry. Tim, welcome to 411 Teen.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Looking so forward to talking with you, and thank you for connecting with us all the way from Pasadena, California.
Sure, no problem.
Tim, would you share some of the issues that parents are confronted with when they have a child that is identified as a special needs child?
Well, you know, it starts to when you determine the need, and some children, you know, like my son at birth, had Down syndrome and then developed autism a couple years later. But it's when you determine that they need something special, they are a special needs person. That's when, you know, a lot of the issues come up. You know, the first issue is a kind of a general issue about how the parents feel. You have a sense of loss, and you really, you know, I tell people, like new parents, when they talk to me, I go, well, how did you deal with that? I said, well, you're really not. It's like you're upset about something that's not really there, because the child that you expected wasn't there. Now, this is a different child, and this different child has special needs, but they also have special rewards. So you need to keep that in mind, that there's you're going to have a different path, but it's going to be the same type of path. The path will be filled with challenges, but it'll be filled with different types of rewards, just like any normal child you have. And one thing that I try to tell people is you have to remember, and this is just how society is, but society views people, like if you or I were walking down the street and we met each other, we'd say, okay, what do you do and what do I do? And say, well, you have this radio program, or I was an accountant, or I worked in an oil field. And you'd say, wow, that's kind of cool what you do. And you'd celebrate each other for what you can do, because, you know, there's a lot of things I can do. There's a lot of things I can't do. But when people meet disabled children, their first viewpoint, especially if it's obvious, is they judge them on what they can't do rather than what they can do. And so my advice on people is, as you work with your child as he grows up, find the things they can do, encourage the things they can do, and work on the things that they can't do that you want them to do, but don't be caught up in the fact that they can't do X or they can't do Y, because then you're not reinforcing what they can do and getting those strengths developed.
So in essence, what you're saying is, you know, play to those strengths, play to those positives, because all children have some positives, they have some strengths, and what we need to do is focus on them as opposed to what you're saying, what you can't do, what your limitations are.
Right, because special needs children learn different things at different times. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean they can't learn it. It's a different challenge, and sometimes even the professionals, the school districts, and the healthcare people who give you advice, they box people in on, like, okay, there's a general category, that's general category, mm-hmm. and they think, well, okay, well, your son's in kindergarten, so next year he better be doing this in first grade. Next year he better be doing this in second grade. When you have a special needs child, that stuff changes, and you got to tell these school districts and principals and IEP people, you know, that they got to work with your child as they are. Like, I pulled my son out of school fourth grade to homeschool him and left my job because I didn't believe the school district was doing a good job raising him, because they were like, okay, well, he can't do that, and then he can't do that. And I said, well, he can't do it now, but if I train him, I think he can do it. One example of that is, you know, he had his feet would be out, you know, tilted outwards when he walked, and it was kind of like a duck walking, and he'd walk, and it was bad for his legs and ankles, and so they wanted to put braces on his feet and his legs. And I said, no, because I recognized when I walked him, when I turned him, he turned his feet in. So instead of putting braces on to correct it where he wouldn't like it and then wouldn't walk and it'd be difficult to get him to walk, what I did is I walked him, and I walked him, and I turned him around in a circle, then I walked him, turned him around in a circle. So we walked down, turned circle left 360, then circled right. And after a couple of years, the turning caused him to turn his feet in on the turn, which caused him to self-correct his gait so that he now has a normal gait. Now, it took a couple of years, but, you know, I didn't have to deal with issues of trying to have him wear braces for the rest of his life, et cetera. So there's always alternatives, and you got to explore those alternatives based on what your son can do or your daughter can do, and then work with whatever they give you, and then develop that.
In preparation for today's program, I spoke with several parents who have special needs children, and particularly those who had autism. I sit on a board for autism here in Florida, and they shared with me a number of feelings, a myriad of feelings that they experienced in finding out that their child was autistic. And I wanted to kind of run some of these feelings by you to see how you coped with them, because this is a question that they had asked that I explore.
Sure.
One of the parents talked about feeling very responsible, okay? And she felt like, although she cognitively was aware that she did not cause this problem, at some point she said she would often feel like, what could I have done? What did I do? Did I cause this? And I'm wondering, could you speak to that?
Well, I think, you know, I talked to a lot of people with special needs. That's a very common trait. And once you understand the commonness of that trait, you'll understand there's not something special that you did. It's more relationship. My wife had that for a long period of time, still does to some extent. Like, well, what did I do wrong? You know, I lived my life, and why did this happen to me? Mm-hmm. I viewed it a little bit different way. I view it as like, you know, you get dealt cards, and how you play your cards is important, not what cards you get. And the way I deal with that is it's a randomness. They don't know what causes autism, and so you can. And I used to tell my wife this all the time. I said, you can worry about what caused it all time for a year, for 2 years, for 3 years. It's not going to get him to walk straight, and it's not going to get rid of his autism. So you really need to focus on something else. But I think as a mother, I think it's a different thing to do, because I think a mother always looks out for their children and is always questioning what they can do to make their children's lives better, so they feel a little sense of responsibility from being a mother, and it's like something innate that they did or they didn't do, especially when there's no real cause. See, when you don't know what the cause of it is, you don't know whether you're responsible or not, so you kind of think it's kind of a way of coping to some extent, say, well, look, if I was responsible for this, maybe it's a justification of why you need to spend more time with your children. Say, well, if I'm responsible for this, I should spend more time, or I should do this more for him. And when you're going to, you know, natural thing is most parents are going to do that for them anyway. So it's not a question of really responsibility. You have nothing, you did nothing wrong. There's nothing you did that was responsible for it. Mm-hmm. It's just something that happened and something that you got to deal with. It's going to be additional challenges, but you're going to have you're going to have those rewarded moments, and those rewarded moments are even better.
Another emotion that one of the parents identified was feeling very resentful and jealous of, this was particularly in her family, of family members who had, quote, unquote, normal kids.
Yeah, I think that's typical, too. I mean, I don't know if it's an outright jealousy where it's like, oh my God, you have a normal kid. I think it's more of a self-reflecting thing where you're like, you feel sorry for yourself a little bit because you're like, all right, well, I got to do this, and look, everybody I know doesn't have to do this. I'm the only one I know has to go through this. You know, it's kind of a why me scenario,
mm-hmm.
and it's not really. And I think it's a natural occurrence, and if you understand it's a natural thing, it's like just like a responsibility kind of thing. It's the same thing. It's going to be natural because it's like, why me? Why, you know, I have to deal with these issues. Why should I have to deal with these issues other people do? Mm-hmm. But part of it comes from the misunderstanding of the people who like your brothers and sisters or everybody else who don't understand that. They don't understand what you go through. And I think really that's a person seeking some people to understand, you know, their life and how difficult it is from a time perspective and challenging from a time perspective because you really want somebody to acknowledge the time that you're spending for your kid. Because sometimes with an autism, your son, like my son, can't express that he cares for you, loves the care he's giving. And so by keep you really just like, this is the reason I wrote the song that, you know, we'll talk about later that kind of led to me doing an album and being on the country music charts was, you know, you just want that one, I love you from the child so it can get so you know what you're doing is worthwhile and you feel worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that emotion that you're talking about where you're jealous of some other people. It's really you just want some more people to understand, and you have to understand that it's difficult for them to understand because you really can't. You can intellectually understand something, but until you face that yourself, you don't really understand what it's like.
How does one overcome the hurtful, rude comments that may not be intentional that are made by others?
Well, you know, we've suffered through that. I mean, I take my son to the mall, and my son, to me, is the most beautiful child in the world,
mm-hmm.
just like everybody's child. You know, I take him to the mall, and you have to balance it because there's some beautiful people in the world that will ask you for help, and they'll come by and say, you know, you need help with that? Oh, what a cute kid he is, and let me help you. And there's other people that give you looks and say, why are you at the mall? Why do you bring him out here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not going to tell you you're never going to get angry, because you're going to get angry about it, because, you know, like somebody, you know, I just remember one time that I was in a parking lot, and my son just sat down in the middle of the parking lot, like, and he's a pretty strong kid,
mm-hmm.
so I was trying to get him up, and people were, you know, a woman came by, very wealthy woman in the Cadillac, said, what are you doing to that boy? You're going to try to hurt him. I said, no, I'm just trying to get him up. He's my son. And she's like, you know, well, why'd you bring him to the mall? Why'd you do this? And why'd you do that? And then, you know, there's a group of Hispanic, actually pretty tough-looking gang members walking by, and they basically told her off and said, get out of here, and they helped me. And they said, look, you know what? We understand that because my brother's like that. So. They'll have a lot of people stick together. I found it's kind of unusual, but I tell people this all the time. I found that whenever I'm someplace, it's the poorest people
mm-hmm.
that help you and understand you.
Mm-hmm.
It's the people who've been discriminated against who understand the discrimination that will help you and not allow people to do that for you. So remember, there's always, you know, the problem in society sometimes is there's 10% of everybody of every group can be kind of jerks.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to ignore those 10%, and then the other 90% will make you feel very worthwhile.
Who do you talk to, though? Who do parents talk to? One of the parents mentioned to me that she had a desire. She wanted to talk about her daughter, who's 17 and wears a diaper, okay? And that's exactly the way she said it. She said, I want to talk about my daughter, but nobody listens. Nobody understands where I'm coming from, okay?
Well, you know, you're talking to my son. She's 17. I would tell her there's still hope.
Mm-hmm.
My son was not potty trained until he was 20 years old.
Okay.
And it took me 13 years to potty train him. And I put him on the toilet 20 times a day, every day, till he learned.
Mm-hmm.
And they will eventually learn. But whatever they tell you, if you keep putting them on the toilet every day for years and years and years, they will get it. I mean, that they told me my son would never be potty trained, and he's potty trained 100% with me, 97% with my wife, and anybody else I can tell them what to do with him to where he's not only potty trained, where he'll give me clues that he has to go to the bathroom, but he will also hold his bathroom until he gets to the toilet. So there is hope. You can do it, but you can't give up on it. And that's a tough thing to do because you don't know how much time you think in your mind, how much time am I wasting if he never does this? And then I thought to myself, well, how much time, what am I going to say, years later if I spent all that time, going out to parties or going out and having fun, knowing that I didn't try.
Mm-hmm.
But the who to talk to is always a tough thing because people really don't understand. When my son was born, one of the most interesting things to me was when I came back to work, I was like a pariah. And it wasn't, everybody was just afraid. They didn't understand what to say to me. Do you say, when your child's born, he's handicapped, do you say, people would come in and say, I'm sorry. If you need to talk, we'll talk. And that's all good. But sometimes what you just need is some normalcy. Sometimes what I needed is somebody say, hey, congratulations, you had a baby.
Right.
And it took that only that one person to do it for me to, respond, and then other people kind of got it. So you really got to find somebody, whether it's in a group of people that are have disabled children. There's lots of groups there that you can go to and join and talk to people about it. But if you talk to people who are, say, have normal kids, unquote, they're not going to get it because they don't have those experiences, and then they're going to feel sorry for you, so they don't know what to say. And it's not because they feel bad or they feel better than you or anything else. It's just they don't have the experience to be able to talk about it, and you have to understand that.
Okay. Will you hold your thoughts for 1 minute? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and we are honored to have Tim Sweeney, who is joining us. He has a son who has Down syndrome and is autistic, and Tim is sharing his experiences with 411 Teen. He joins us from Pasadena, California. Tim, one thing before we get into your music, there are a couple other things I wanted to ask you about. Parents, research has indicated that often marriages hit the rocks in response to the birth of a special child. Why does this happen? And are there some insights you could share for parents who are having to cope with this to help them avoid this?
That is a tough question because you see it all the time, and I think it, and to some extent, it's inevitable because, like my son, it requires 24-hour care 7 days a week. So my wife and I try to do this. We don't want him into a group home or an institution or anything like that. And so, I'll watch him for 6 hours, and she'll watch him for 6 hours, and I'll watch him for 6 hours, and she'll watch him for 6 hours, and that leads to a couple things. Number one, it's you don't ever have time together because one of you is always watching the child, and it's you need some kind of relief from that. But when you get relief, what people understand is when you get relief and you get a babysitter or you get a state caretaker, you're still not relief. People think, oh well, you got a babysitter, well now you can do it. But it never leaves your mind that your son is with somebody else, and you have to trust them to take care of him because nobody takes care of their children better than parents.
Right.
For almost 99% of the time. And so you have this, the first problem you have is the time. You don't have the same time together, and so your relationship changes. The second problem with it is that you end up feeling like when you're watching the child, your spouse is having fun doing something, and then you're resentful, like, well, they're doing something, they're fun, and then they watch them, and you're doing something, and you're really not doing something fun, but just the perceptions that you're doing this alone without help. Mm. But you can't do it together 24 hours a day, so naturally that causes, you know, a change in your relationship. And I think what you have to do is you have to sit down and understand that the time that everybody's spending is for the child, and so you actually give up a little bit of yourself. You give up a little bit of your relationship, and it has to be okay with everybody. So it can't be one person saying, "Well, I think you should do that," or "I can't do that, so you need to do more of it." It has to be kind of a joint sharing, and then you got to work out the resources that the state gives you, and then you got to get people who are qualified, who you trust, to help take care of your child in the interim. And that's just a difficult thing to do. And so I don't know if I have any real answers, because I understand that happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know a lot of families. I don't know what the statistics are, but I think when you have a special needs kid, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, a good percentage of the marriages end up, you know, on the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, you know, I've been to places where people say, "Oh, you're still with your wife when you have that kid, and you're mm-hmm. still with the kid. I mean, why didn't you leave?" Because people leave. And, you know, I kind of view it like this. I mean, I was a real smart guy growing up and was real successful, and my son's handicapped, and he's very mentally challenged. I didn't do anything to be smart. He didn't do anything to be like mm-hmm. he is. So, you know, I'm going to – I don't want people to reward me just for something that I really didn't do myself, and I don't want somebody to punish him for something he didn't do himself. And so when you have it that way, you think, okay, well, I'm just going to give the time necessary so my son can be the best, just like other people do with their children, but a little bit different. But to say I have answered that, I think the answer is you just have to understand your relationship is going to change, and because you have a child that didn't do anything wrong that needs basically that relationship to change to get the help and care they need. And it's like anything else. Once you understand that, it's easier to live with than if you try to fight that, because I think people try to fight that. And all the other issues we talked about, it's like, well, it's my responsibility, or I don't have anybody to talk to, or people give me comments. When you're flooded with all that, those are all legitimate concerns. But you got to filter that out from, like, none of that really matters, to getting him to learn to swim, like I taught my son over a 9-year period to swim. And some of the joyous occasions is like he gets in that pool and starts swimming. You know, he can't talk, he can't do a lot of things, but he can swim. You know, it's in just like the music. My son is mentally disabled to the point where, when he was a kid, he didn't know cause effect relationships, but he liked music. So I played music, and I got these little things where you'd push a button and a little stuffed animal would sing a song or something like that. And he liked them, and I would push him. And over a period of years, it was from me pushing that, and then he'd hand it to me to push again, and he'd take it away, then he'd hand it to push it. And he learned over years how to push those things in cause and effect, but transferred over to all other kinds of things of cause and effect, relationships, and knowing things are object permanence. Mm-hmm. He knew things were there when you hit him because he was looking for that music. So if you use what they are, what lights them up, what really intrigues them, whatever it is, whether it's music or anything else, if you use that to help them learn, then you're kind of better off. But really the key to your question is an understanding, and mm-hmm. it's a difficult thing.
How do you cultivate, though, a milieu that is supportive of your special child? And when I say a milieu, I don't just mean the immediate home, but I mean the community, I mean your neighborhood, I mean even family members can be, you know, ignorance is real painful.
Well, one good thing my wife used to always do when she'd like take him to the mall, if somebody would, she'd walk up and say, "You want to meet Timmy? You should meet him and talk to him." It's unfortunate, but it's like I said, it's like, you know, anything that's the kind of out of the normal in society is kind of strange. And let me give you a little story. My song is Baby I Try For You, and I did a mm-hmm. video for it. And in the video, I used sign language in the video. Against, like, everybody told me in Nashville, like, well, you don't, that's kind of out of the norm. If you do, that's kind of strange. But I used sign language as an artistic element in the performance. And I'm glad I did, because I have some fans in the United Kingdom who are deaf. I also used some actors who were deaf, and the director, Jules Dameron, was a great director who happens to be deaf. Even my sound editor was deaf. But that was back in my focus on the issue of, you know, what people can do rather than what they can't do. If you ask people what they can do, don't have any presuppositions about what they can mm-hmm. or can't do, because people will surprise you. But in the United Kingdom, there was a group of young women who were deaf who liked my song in the sign language, and they reiterated the story to me. After my video came out, they liked the video because it was inclusive in the deaf and hard of hearing community, which does like music, but they listen to music in a different way. And so they'd go to the park for day after day after year, and people would look at them like they were strange and they wouldn't approach them. Well, they learned my song, the sign language of my song, they did it in unison together, and you know, the day they did this little performance, they were just doing it for each other. And then all the people in the park came up, hey, that's cool. Mm. You know, they started interacting with people. It's like, oh, they can do something cool. That's something we can't do. Because sign language is really a beautiful language, and it's really artistic. And it's really, you know, people who learn all the aspects of sign language, you have to be pretty smart to do it. So just because you can't talk doesn't mean you're not a really smart person.
When Timmy was diagnosed with Down syndrome and autism, how did you and your wife cope with the diagnosis? How did you receive it?
Well, that was different, because Timmy was also 3 months premature.
Okay.
And I was in California, and she was in Illinois visiting her parents. And when I came there, I didn't know. It was kind of like, oh, they were trying to stop the labor, and so I was just, you know, I just showed up after all this had occurred. And, you know, I don't think the hospitals handled it all that well, because, I mean, the first thing they did is when they told me he had Down syndrome, because autism came in a couple years later.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, you know, say it's Down syndrome, and I was like, oh, I thought, you know, because I looked around and everybody was sad. I thought my son had died mm-hmm. during childbirth. And I said, oh, well, is that all it is? So I said, I want to see him. They said, well, let's go to counseling first. I go, well, I don't want to go to counseling first. I want to see my kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing they said to me, you know, they said, look, we just want you to know that there are people, loving people, who will adopt these children. And so they presupposed that I would give my child up. I said, I don't know who you're talking to, but I'm going to go down and see my kid, and I don't want you to talk to me like that again. And I've actually got a pretty strong disposition. I think people, once you have a special needs kid, no matter how you are, you got to have a strong disposition.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be, you know, bossy or argumentative, but you have to say, I know this is right. Like my son was in a school district, and he can't talk and he can't read. He's pretty much at a 1.5-year-old level, and so I took him out of school to teach him basic living school skills. You know, when you go back to have him tested periodically to see how the homeschooling's gone, they go, okay, we're going to give him a math placement test. I go, do you get this? I go, you're sitting there looking at him. He can't talk. And, you know, he just kind of sits there, and he's very friendly and everything. But you know he can't talk. You know he can't read. You know he has autism. You know he has Down syndrome. You know he has severe mental retardation. And you're going to give him a test to see where he is on the high school math placement level?
What?
I said, why would I do that? And they go, well, you know, we got to take these tests to see where he is. I go, you can look at him and see where he is.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, don't offend me. Mm-hmm. And I think people get offended like that. It's offensive when you spend, you know, 13 years potty training your son, and they said, well, that's no big deal, or let's give him a math test. And so you have to be hardened a little bit and expect that, because mm-hmm. I just don't think the system, even though there's a lot of services available for disabled children nowadays, I don't think the system is caught up with, you know, understanding where parents are and their perspectives about their kids.
For the listening audience, would you just share briefly what is Down syndrome?
Down syndrome is trisomy 21. It's mm-hmm. an extra chromosome on your 21st chromosome. Usually you have a one from the mother and one from the father, and this is where, instead of having two and forming the DNA, it's three. So it's like, I describe it as like, you know, if a tree is growing and you put a BB or something in the middle of the tree as it grows, it'll grow around it and it'll change, it'll be different. And that's kind of what Down syndrome is. It causes a range of issues, some health issues, some heart problems, developmental problems, some mental developmental problems. Down syndrome kids, have a range of mental development to people like my son who's profoundly challenged mentally mm-hmm. to almost normal. Mm-hmm. And you have certain things that you can look at them like folds on your eyes and things like that are kind of common. But it's just something that interfered with the growth the way it was supposed to mm-hmm. be, and so it didn't match up exactly.
Okay. Yeah, a chromosomal condition.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Just for the listening audience, and it's most common, you know, it has genetic birth abnormalities, I guess a good way to say that.
And right.
Syndrome, by definition, is a collection of symptoms. So you've got varied symptoms. They may be developmental. They may be physical. There may be mental. So you've got a combination of different things that are going on.
Right, and it's just no different than your other regular child.
Right.
They have a lot of different things going on, too. It's just
mm-hmm.
a different level. That's what people don't realize. It's like people go, well, it must be tough raising your son. I go, it is, but not that one.
Well, my question was going to be, share some of the joys. And people always think about, oh, the demands. I know it was so challenging. But would you share some of the joys that you have experienced in raising Timmy?
Well, one of the biggest joys, which is all, you know, this is music, is when he couldn't sleep, I would sing him to sleep. And I started with Home on the Range, and I would sing songs to him. And I would make up my own songs, which is like almost 90% of the songs on my album this time, which is available on iTunes, I have to say that.
Oh, yes, yes. Tell us how, I'm glad you emphasized that. Tell the listening audience how they can connect to your album.
Oh, they can go to timsweeneymusic.com and listen to all my songs, or they can go to Tim Sweeney Music on Facebook, or they can just go Tim Sweeney This Time on iTunes, and they can listen to either stream the entire song or parts of the songs. But when I would sing them these songs, I would make them over years as I made up different songs,
mm-hmm.
and I would sing to him. One of the funniest things is if he likes a song, he would like, he'd sleep, and I'd think he'd be asleep. If he liked the song, I'd stop singing. He'd just tilt his head up and look at me and smile, and then I knew that I had to like keep singing. And if I came a song that the funniest thing that happened ever, I would sing him a song, and if he didn't like it, he'd put his hand on my mouth.
Oh. He made his point clear.
Yeah, he's
don't
like
sing
Clive
that.
The Clive Davis of country music. He's like, puts his hand on my mouth. No, that's not a hit.
That's great.
But, you know, it's all kinds of things. It's like, you know, the victories when he'll be sitting there and he'll be playing with a toy or something and you'll be like, oh, gosh, that happened. He'll walk up and just sit in your lap and look at you like, it's okay. Or he'll come and pat you on the back or, you know, the little victories he has when he learns how to put his clothes on with assistance as opposed to like not knowing he cooperates with stuff, you know, cooperates with brushing his teeth and cooperates all these little victories. And he's the nicest human being. I mean, he's like, you know, the look that these kids give you when they love you is worth all the effort.
Wow. How did you identify the educational services that were available, although it doesn't sound like they were too great?
Well, you know, they can be and they can't be depending on the people
okay.
in the state and the city and the people even within, you know, the different people you get. I'm a pretty practical person, and I'm looking at people, and I think a lot of times people go along with what the professionals say, and to some extent I think you people should take the different opinions of people, but you got to make your own decision based on you knowing your kid. And it's like I just had the other day. I took my son, and he's still, until he's 22, he still goes to school district like tests and things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't let them do stuff that doesn't make any sense to me. I said, look, I'm a smart person, and most people are smart. Most people know instinctively what their kids can do and can do. Like, if my son can't talk, I don't really want him in a singing contest. Doesn't, you know,
right.
It's like, just because you won't need another person in this program so you can get your funding, I don't really care. So you gotta speak up for yourself. One of the issues that I really have, I'm actually fighting for my son in California, is the state provides care to developmentally disabled children and adults.
Tim, let me interrupt you. Hold your thoughts for a moment. We're going to take a break, and you can come back and share that with us, okay?
Okay. Thanks.
All right. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily. Tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with Tim Sweeney in Pasadena, California. He's a parent who has reached his nonverbal son through music. Tim, I had to interrupt you, but you can continue.
Sure. What I was talking about is when one of the things I'm fighting in California for my son on behalf of all the other disabled, developmentally disabled children's programs are, they basically give this, like, take-it-or-leave-it approach. They have, like, cookie-cutter things. They say, well, we have this so you can get this. And I forced them, in my son's case, over a three-and-a-half-year period to actually determine his actual needs based on who he is. And I fought that for 3.5 years, and I just won most of it. And so what I'm trying to get is a recognition that people shouldn't have disabled kids. You have so much, like, you know, we've talked about some of the things you go through. There's so many things they go through. I don't think they should have to go through a situation where they have to fight to get what they need. It should be there's a lot of different disabilities, but the needs are pretty similar, you know, and it's just a level of a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty easy to determine those needs if they want to, and sometimes the states use it as a way of parceling out care or limited dollars. And so you end up with this problem that you live X place and you get $10 a care, and you live Y place, you get $30 a care,
mm-hmm.
and if you fight, you get $80, and if you don't fight, you get $10. I think, you know, it's really not about the fighting or where you live. It should be everybody gets the same care for the same disability. And so that's kind of what I've been fighting.
Oh. How did you make the music video?
The music video was very interesting because I didn't start to be a country music star. I kind of just wanted to go to Nashville to record these songs so my son would always have them. And then I started thinking about doing a video for a song. And I thought I'd, you know, put a little bit on my credit card and do a video. But I found this director, Jules Dameron, who works with sign language, and I put the sign language as a performance element in the video. And when I sat down with her and some people in the deaf community to try to be one of the first music videos that included sign language,
mm-hmm.
You know, everybody just came and volunteered. It ended up being like 100 people, almost all of which volunteered either 100% or 80% of their time without pay to be in the project so they could do the video. And that's how we got the video started, and we put it on YouTube, and it just kind of blew up. It's now almost 1 million views. And that led to, you know, my CD being, like, commercially available on iTunes. And the video is, if you put Tim Sweeney and Baby I Try For You, or just Tim Sweeney and Baby in YouTube, you'll see the video.
Oh, okay. All right. And again, would you share with the listening audience where and how they can connect? I know you just said it, but say it
again. I would suggest that everybody watch the video. Go Tim Sweeney, Baby I Try For You. It's on YouTube. Or go to timsweeneymusic.com or Tim Sweeney music on Facebook. I have updates on everything, and that's how they can kind of connect with it.
Okay. What's the significance of the title?
This Time?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a song. There's a song on there that This Time that is really a cool song. It's like a take this job and shove it kind of song.
Mm-hmm.
It's about taking time for yourself. So you can see how it kind of relates. And it has a refrain saying basically, this time it's going to be about me. And it's like you got to take a little time for yourself during your life. Even though like my son, when I wrote it, it was partially about one of my handicapped son, and partially about my other son. Said, look. You know, I want to do what I want to do. You know, and singing to my son, my handicapped son, is like from a parent's perspective, you still got to do stuff that's normal. You got to do what you want to do and be what you want to be. And you don't necessarily have to play by the rules all the time if the rules are inconsistent with what you actually know in your heart to be true.
When you think about disabilities, whether it's Down syndrome or autism, why do you feel people misunderstand, I guess, the value of those with these handicaps or disabilities?
It's like I said earlier, they don't understand the value because they judge people on a different perspective. They judge disabled people based on what they can't do. They say, oh, look at that person. He can't do this, and he can't do this, and he can't do this. It's like the deaf community. The deaf community, the only difference between it, and I spent a lot of time doing the video with the deaf community, and they are fantastic people in the deaf community. And they're just like you and me. And what I realized and what I think people should realize is a deaf community is just like a foreign language. Mm-hmm. They speak a different language.
Exactly.
It doesn't make them any different than you. They just speak a foreign language. And they speak their language better than you speak their language. I mean, I would go in these meetings where everybody was talking sign language, I felt like there were a bunch of college professors, and I was in third grade. I was pretty highly educated, and so it's when you look at it the your way, you're like, well, that's not something. You know, everything's different than what if something's different from what you are normally accustomed to seeing. You generally think that your way is the best, and that way's bad, but it's just different.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at disabled people, it's really they do something different. There's something they can't do, but that doesn't mean there's something there's always something that they can do that you really should focus on, because it's not really fair. You and I mean, when we had this call, you didn't like start asking me, well, what, you can't play tennis, or you can't fix an engine, or you can't do this. We never focus on what we can't do, because we're so-called normal people. But it's really not. Everybody has things they can do, and everybody has things they can't do. And you just got to focus on your child who is disabled and what they can do, and make sure that other people who don't have disabled children understand that that should be the focus.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions I forgot to ask you, and I know I must, a common question that came up when talking with parents. I've heard parents say that they have a particular fear about the future. And, you know, I asked them, elaborate, tell me what you mean. And they would share with me that they were really concerned about what happens to their child after they are gone. Do you have any insights as to how to handle this, you know, particularly with your legal background? Any suggestions of how people need to address this major concern?
It's a major issue. I mean, all these issues you're talking about, my family's gone through, and I've gone through, and my wife's gone through. That's a major issue. I mean, it's your constant worry, because you take so much time and care and devoted. As long as you're there, you'll fight for that person. And you'll get the care, and they'll be safe. And then you think, well, what happens when I'm gone? Who's going to do this? And you have to find out who you can trust to do it. But you need to set up a system, like whether it be a special needs trust, or if you have any kind of assets, or like what I do with what I'm dealing with and fighting with the state is, I'm trying to get exactly his situation set up to where he'd be independent living, and that would continue after I was gone. And you got to fight harder now so they won't fight him later. So you establish a precedent in what kind of care the state and what kind of benefits he receives now, so you get that in set up for when you're gone, And then you have to find somebody in your family who is willing, and, you know, maybe one or two or three people who are willing to monitor that situation so that, you know, everybody has a fear. I have the same fear. When I'm gone, are they going to put my son in a institution?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to put my son in a group home where he's going to be taken advantage of one way or another? Because group homes, at least in California, are profit-making activities.
Exactly.
So it's two people taking care of eight people. And, you know, my son can't speak up, so what's going to happen to him if he's abused? Nobody will know. So that's not a situation I want my son. And I know that that's the fear that people have is, you know, I'm taking all this effort to take care of him, and it's a legitimate concern. That I tell my wife, I said, you got to quit worrying about it and start planning for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you plan for it is you make sure he's set up right now so that he doesn't need your care, and then so you can monitor his care and participate in his care, and then when you're gone, you've established that level of care that he needs, and you have to have somebody else step in to take over and do that monitoring.
Okay. We're coming to the last few minutes, and I still have 1,000 questions I'd like to ask you. But when we look at the arts, and we look at music, and we look at art, we know it's often overlooked in the educational system. And when you talk with parents who have children who have learning disabilities or special needs, you often find that music and art are really the mediums through which the children may flourish. How do you deal with that?
You just have to encourage it. Like what I did is I saw he liked music, and I mean, you think about this. And I try to tell people, I go, you know, people are successful. You look up the people who are successful. Like Steve Jobs of Apple Computer is like mm-hmm. one person that like was a marvel. Really, he did basically everything in his job right, and he made billions of dollars, and he's a great success. But he really wasn't a success because he made billions of dollars, because he really didn't flaunt his money like other people do.
Right.
He was a success because of how he inspired others, how he inspired other computer programs, the internet, and everything else. So his legacy is really, he was an inspiring person, and he was successful by the number of people he inspired and became successful because of him, the other people that he made successful. Now, your child is disabled, but your child can inspire you. If you look at my situation, I wasn't somebody who was like, you know, singing in bars my whole life, and now I'm discovered, and now I'm a big country music star. I was inspired by my son. He inspired me to write the song for him. Without him, I wouldn't have had any, without playing that guitar where he would come up and have some interest in the music, without his interest in music, I wouldn't have developed this interest. I wouldn't have written the song.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have been now on, like, the country music breakout chart in Nashville. So your child's successes are not only limited, are not just what he can accomplish, but what he can inspire you to accomplish and what he can inspire others to accomplish, he or she. And so if you look at it from that perspective, music, when my son showed that he liked music, I used that music to encourage him to learn all his behaviors. I used that to help him, use that intensity, that like he has for music, to help him learn everything, and
mm-hmm.
in that process, it inspired me to learn more things. And you know, I attribute every kind of, you know, like I was telling somebody the other day on another radio station, I said, you know, if I'm successful at all at this, what makes me happy is I view that as his success. He is so successful if the song or the record is a success because these are his songs.
Well, in essence, what you're saying is that music or maybe that art is a bridge. Between.
Yeah, it is. It is like a bridge. It's a bridge from what they can't do to what they can do, and whatever, let them select the bridge. You mm-hmm. just help them build it.
It's,
and if it's art or if it's music, encourage that. Encourage whatever they like and whatever mm-hmm. they have some interest in, because that interest will lead to learning.
And in talking to you, what if I encapsulate everything that we've said, basically. What you have said, what I've taken away from this conversation is a lot. With parents, it has to be your mindset, the mindset that you have in approaching dealing with your special child.
Yeah, you have to, you know, I don't think people should have to be warriors with the state and getting the benefits.
Right.
But you have to be, you have to have a different little perspective on mm-hmm. on your special needs a child. You can't be like, you know, my other son is, oh, well, he's out there playing, and he'll learn something with the kids in the neighborhood and things like that. Mm-hmm. You have to be focused on them a little bit. And, you know, that's difficult for some people because you have a job and you have other things, and it's really demanding and it's really challenging. But it is really rewarding. And especially when you see, you know, if I see other disabled children who I saw like 5 years ago, and you see their learned behaviors even better, it really kind of touches my heart. And every child, the only difference between my child and other children is he learns things slower. And you know, like I tease my wife sometimes. He goes, he doesn't do that. I go, maybe he just doesn't like to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't like to do everything.
That's true.
You know, it's like, you know, like you're going to expect him to like all kinds of foods. You don't like all kinds of foods.
Right. So you got to be realistic.
Yeah. But see, you're more focused on what they can't do. That's the same mm-hmm. thing. It's like even as parents, you're like, oh, he can't do this and he can't do that. I got to make sure he can do this. I got to make sure he do mm-hmm. that. And you can't focus on what they can't do. You really have to change your mindset. You can't fill in the gaps of what they can't do. You can work towards that, but you got to get whatever they give you, whatever they're working at. You know, it's like toilet training. Like I spent 13 years of toilet training. It's like, well, people say, okay, well, you know, how do you spend that much time? I go, because I knew it would be successful. Mm-hmm. Because I know even animals do not like to go to the bathroom. They go away to go to the bathroom. So I said, if I do this enough, mm-hmm. I'm sure that he will kind of get it. Now, I was lucky because after, you know, I was right. But I would have still, if he hadn't learned it, I'd still be doing it today because I would still hope that he would learn it. And that's a tough thing is you got to be consistent and persistent.
Okay. Well, listen, Tim, it has been real. And I want to extend a really sincere appreciation for you sharing your time and your expertise with 411 Teen. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcasts, log in wfsu.org.